Okay, so welcome back. Last time we discussed viscous hydrodynamics, the Navier-Stokes equations, and then we started to discuss magneto hydrodynamics, and this is where if I want to continue now. So just as a brief reminder, essentially what we set out to do is to describe plasma in the presence of electric and magnetic fields in the sort of simplest possible approximation known as magnetohydrodynamics, which essentially is defined by these sort of four central assumptions that we listed last time. So the plasma needs to be treatable essentially as a continuous medium in the same way as we did for the Euler equation or for the Navier-Stokes equation. So in the absence of electromagnetic fields, that should be the correct approximation. Then we were requiring that positive and negative charges locally and globally balance each other. So there are no long-range forces between different fluid elements due to electromagnetic effects. And then also we require that electrons are in statistical equilibrium with ions, so that all the sort of different charges have the same temperature, so we don't need to include or sort of consider a multi-component fluid or treat different families of charges sort of in different individual ways. And then finally, we also assume that the collisions are so frequent enough so that essentially all forces, electromagnetic forces, are shared among all ions, so among all species, essentially instantaneously. In particular, that collisions happen between frequently enough between neutral particles and charged particles. And so that the forces are felt essentially by all the species in a given fluid element. Okay, and so essentially the plan is to couple Maxwell's equations with the hydrodynamic equations. And we started to do that by just writing down the Maxwell's equations and then making a few approximations already. So for example, we're showing by essentially just dimensional analysis that this term here on the right hand side can be neglected as long as we are looking at a non-relativistic plasma. And so the next approximation that we're going to do is related to this one, and this is actually sort of addressing the question that that Eric had at the end of last of the last lecture, and I just wanted to briefly address here in a little more detail what actually happens with Gauss's law. So up here, so what are we actually doing with the charge density on the right hand side? And so essentially, what I want to show here real quick is that essentially this equation falls out. We can actually drop Gauss's law. As long as we consider a non-relativistic plasma. And so what we can essentially estimate here is essentially what is the force felt by charges due to the acceleration of through the electric field compared to the Lorentz force that is sort of induced by the magnetic field. So if we look at Gauss's law and just estimate sort of on an order of magnitude basis, how this quantity Q times the electric field strength scales, then we'll find that this is the divergence times the electric field. So the divergence scales as essentially the electromagnetic field strength over some characteristic length scale, so the dimensions of electric field strength over length scale. And then we have another factor of the electric field strength up here. So if we just then plug in the assumption that we've made up here last time, so we estimated using the third equation that this estimation here holds. So if I plug this in, we can estimate this to be essentially the plasma, the characteristic plasma velocity over the speed of light squared, and then the magnetic field squared over the characteristic length scale of the system. And now using the fourth equation up here, we can, we can re-express this in terms of the current and the magnetic field strength. So from this fourth equation, essentially, we know that 1 over C times the absolute value of the current is roughly given by the curl of B, meaning that it has dimensions of magnetic field strength over length scale. So if we plug this in, we get V over C squared, and then 1 over C times, current. So which, if we assume we have a non-relativistic plasma, it's much smaller than the Lorentz force, which is exactly this expression. So this is roughly the characteristic value of the Lorentz force. So for a non-relativistic plasma, we can neglect these the force due to the electric field. So essentially, we can neglect effects of the charge density. And so essentially, this means that we can actually drop Gauss's law. So 1 can be dropped. We can simply neglect this as a source of the electric field, so the charge density. Okay, so these are essentially two approximations we make from the beginning. So we essentially ignore Gauss's law, and we set this term down here. This term down here to 0. Okay, now let's try to couple this with the hydrodynamic equation. So there's essentially two or three more steps that we need to do this. So the first one, let's talk about Ohm's law. So you may remember that the current, so in the local rest frame, essentially, of a fluid element, the current is proportional to the electric field. This is Ohm's law. So this is for essentially plasma at rest, where sigma E is the electric conductivity, this proportionality constant. And so if we go into the lab frame and assume that the plasma is moving non-relativistically, then we'll have this expression. So the E field becomes E plus V cross B. So let's call this our fifth relation. So we'll need this to close the system eventually. So let's say this is non-relativistic motion. Now also, since we have currents that flow in the system, there will be ohmic dissipation. So the current will decay. Since there's resistivity, some sort of there's finite conductivity and therefore some sort of resistance. So current decay due to finite conductivity. Which means that this will be dissipated into heat, into internal energy. And so the expression that we need is essentially this one. So this will be conversion of electromagnetic energy into internal energy. So this will be part of the, will become part of the energy equation. And then finally, let's talk about, second to last point, let us discuss the sort of reaction of the B field to the motion of the plasma. So this will lead to the induction equation in our MHD equations. So, and in order to obtain this, we can just use these equations 4 and 5 and substitute 4 into 5. So again, 4 is this relation here between the current and the magnetic field. And then 5 was the expression that related, again, the current to the electric and magnetic field. And so if we just plug this in, we get an expression for the, we can eliminate the current and get a direct relation between the electric field and the magnetic field. So this is just very straightforward algebra. And so this is a direct expression for the electric field, which tells us that at any moment, whenever we know the magnetic field strength and we know the plasma velocity, we can directly calculate the electric field. So we don't need actually an independent evolution equation for the electric field, which is why we will only have the induction equation as another dynamical equation in our MHD set of MHD equations. Now we can plug this in to into relation in into equation 3, and then obtain an evolution equation for the magnetic field, so this is the induction equation. And here I defined eta e as c square over 4 pi sigma e, which is known as the electric resistivity. Okay. So in particular, we can look at this equation for a plasma at rest, just to get an idea of essentially the magnitude of these resistive effects. And so we can essentially, again, by dimensional analysis, associate a timescale with such resistive effects. And this will be important then to distinguish between a resistive MHD approach and what we call an ideal MHD approach. So this is important when we want to study an astrophysical system and sort of need to decide about which methods to use. And as I'll show in a second, well, in a few minutes, for many astrophysical system, ideal MHD is actually a fairly good approximation, which is what most codes these days actually do. Although there are also resistive codes on the market. I was saying we look at this at rest. So the first term disappears, the fluid velocity V is zero. And so again, dimension analysis on the left-hand side, we have the characteristic magnetic field strength over a characteristic time scale, which I call T res for T resistive. And that scales roughly as minus eta E. And then we have this expression here on the right-hand side, which is the curl of B. So this has dimensions of magnetic field strength over length scale squared. So second derivatives. So if we rearrange, if we solve this for the characteristic time scale, see this is given as length scale squared over the resistivity. So this is the typical decay time scale. Of the magnetic field. Due to finite resistivity. And so here you can observe again that eta E has essentially, again, dimensions of length times velocity. So exactly like the turbulent viscosity that we discussed last time. And so this is also why it's sometimes called, so in analogy, magnetic diffusivity. So you'll find that also in books and papers. Okay, so we do have an evolution equation for the magnetic field. We know how to compute the electric field given the electric field given the magnetic field, which is this relation up here. So in principle, those are both defined. We have an additional energy term coming from ohmic dissipation that we need to add to the energy equation. But what about the momentum equation? So we also need to account for the Lorentz force on the plasma. So on the back reaction of the fields on the plasma. So,
Daniel, sorry to interrupt. Yeah. Can I ask? Sure. So, when I look at the equation for dBdt, the evolution equation for the magnetic field.
Yes.
I'm wondering: is it hyperbolic? Is it elliptical? Is it elliptic? Is it a mixed type? Do you know?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'll get to this. I'll show in a second that one can write all of this in terms of a conservation law again, of a system of conservation laws, and one can show that those are again strictly hyperbolic, as long as you're not in vacuum. So as long again as the sound speed stays finite.
Okay, that's interesting because I mean I was looking at the two derivatives. It looks right. Like that might spoil the hyperbolicity of the equation, but I guess you're rewriting it in a different
form. Exactly. So we'll be rewriting it a little bit, and that will be in a hyperbolic form that can be then used for computation, so for numerical applications. Exactly.
Okay, thank you.
And actually, this also holds true in the GR case, in the relativistic case. So we'll get to this as well, but probably on Tuesday. So one can also show that if you go to GR, the complete system of MHD equations in GR are strictly hyperbolic. But those are actually more recent results that were shown in the early 2000s or so. Okay. So let's talk about the back reaction on the plasma. So as I already said, the dominant force will be the Lorentz force. So we'll ignore the contribution coming from the electric field. So again, you may know this is the expression for the Lorentz force. And so we can rewrite this a little bit. Using the expression for the fourth equation, so we just get rid of the of the current, and so what we get is this form, and then just by basic identities for these differential operators and vector fields, you can rewrite this in the following form. And so these are just general vector identities. And there are two things to point out here. So here on the right hand, so this the second term here on the right, you'll see that there's a gradient of a scalar function of the square of the magnetic field strength, and so this is the gradient of a scalar function, and you'll see that and external forces will go into the momentum equation F on the right hand side. So this exactly looks like the actual fluid pressure P. So, and in analogy, this is called the magnetic pressure. There's a magnetic pressure force. And this is often denoted by Pm for magnetic is B squared over 8 pi. And so on the left, we have another term that is referred to as magnetic tension. And as this is really due, as you can see here through the gradient, it's due to the curvature of magnetic field lines. So this force essentially vanishes if the magnetic field is constant. Essentially along straight lines. So then you'll have no force from that term. Okay, so we sort of decomposed the back reaction force onto the plasma, and now we can essentially write down the modified hydrodynamics equations. So obviously mass conservation still holds, so the continuity equation is unchanged, which I'll just write down. Now, the momentum equation will be modified by this contribution of the Lorentz force. So here again, we have the divergence of this momentum flux density pi that we defined last time, and then first on the right-hand side here, I'll put the magnetic tension contribution. Then we have the contribution from the magnetic pressure. And then still we may have some additional other external forces like gravity or something else that we may want to specify. So I'll just leave this here as rho F. then the equation for the total energy, as I mentioned, we have in the presence of finite conductivity of the medium, we have ohmic dissipation that leads to generation of heat in the medium. So here on the right-hand side, we have this additional term 4 pi c squared eta e plus rho, and then again, we may have some external force field. And so here you can obviously see that if eta e is zero, so if we have infinite conductivity or perfectly conducting medium, which is what, so this limit is what we call ideal MHD, that term obviously vanishes. So then there's no ohmic dissipation, and the energy equation is essentially unchanged. And then finally, the only additional evolution equation that we need in this MHD approach, as I mentioned, is just the induction equation. And again, here we have two terms. One is the one due to finite conductivity here that vanishes in the ideal limit. And we have the V cross B term, curl of V cross B term here. And so this is already the set of MHD equations. That is essentially the basis for lots and lots and lots of applications in astrophysics. And I should note down that usually you will see them in, not in this sort of more general resistive setting, but in the so-called ideal MHD approximation. Where eta e is just set to zero. And this is very true in sort of many astrophysical plasma, simply because there's lots of free charges and you can essentially treat it as a medium that is perfectly conducting. So we'll actually make some estimates in just a minute about this and point out some limitations as well. So I just wanted to get back real quick regarding Eric's questions of hyperbolicity. And so this is actually something that I will put on the second problem set. So there's something for you to play with the equations to get a little bit familiar with this and how to transform sort of these equations that I've written down here into a conservative form, into a conservation form. You will actually see that there some modifications need to be done, especially for the energy equation. So you can actually write this down, and this will be, as I said, an exercise in conservation form. So again, the continuity equation is fine. We still already have the divergence type nature here. And then for the momentum equation, one needs to define a conserved momentum. And then we have the divergence of a tensor here, T. So this is conservation of momentum. And then we have an equation for the conserved energy tau, which is different from the total energy that I've written up here, which is just the sum of the kinetic and the internal energy. And so there will be some quantities here. So this is conservation of energy. And then finally, we can transform the induction equation into a hyperbolic type. And so again, here we have a a tensor that I just called Y here for the moment. It's also a rank 2 tensor. And then on the right-hand side, we actually have a source term here. And so what this last essentially law tells us is essentially the sort of conservation or non-conservation of magnetic flux. So this is a balance law because in presence of finite connectivity, magnetic field is dissipated. So as we estimated up here, and so the magnetic field will decay on this typical timescale T res. And so magnetic flux, if you just sort of leave it there and you look at the plasma address, you let everything relax, the magnetic field will decay. And so the magnetic flux will not be conserved. Which is why you'll actually have a negative term here on the right hand side, which I just call here, which I just denote here by S resistive. And so you can, in other words, you can write this as a system of as a system of conservation laws where this vector U will just collect all these different, sort of the mass density, the conserved momentum, conserved energy, and the magnetic field vector. And then sort of for the fluxes, obviously, we collect these expressions here, T, U, and Y, and then the source term. So strict conservation laws for all quantities except for the magnetic field in the presence of resistivity. Now I won't write down all these expressions because this is very lengthy, but I'll encourage you to work on the second problem set next week, which will come out next week on this. So this will be a really good exercise to get a little bit familiar with the MHD equations and the Euler equations, some of the assumptions we've been making along the ways, and how to transform this into a conservation type system. And for this system, one can actually show it's strictly hyperbolic. So, and this is why we exactly need this form if we want to do numerical evolutions with these equations and study astrophysical systems numerically. So everyone interested in MHD should essentially do this at least once. Okay, sort of skipping these exercises, let's again talk a little bit about some limits of this MHD approximation with respect to some astrophysical systems that we might be broadly interested in. And so the first one again is, so one of the critical assumptions, as I mentioned a few times along the way, is obviously this collision regime. So when we get out of the collision into the collisionless regime, then obviously the MHD approximation breaks down. And one reason is, for example, that the drift velocity. So at the end of the last lecture, we estimated essentially that the relative velocity between positive and negative charges is actually very small with respect to on the order of 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 10 to the minus 5 centimeters per second or so, compared to astrophysical fluid motions that are typically on the order of at least a few kilometers per second, in many systems up to tens, hundreds of kilometers per second. But this approximation of the drift velocity being small so this local screening of charges only holds obviously as long as these magnetic charges have encounter frequent enough collisions so that they can actually not maintain a net relative speed to other species. So the drift velocity is small. So as long as forces due to large scale fields are balanced by so the frictional forces due to interparticle collisions. So one easy way we can actually estimate when this breaks down is the following. So this breaks down. So when do we expect this decoupling point of charges to occur? Well, typically, one can think that essentially, if the cyclotron frequency, so the frequency with which charges would gyrate in a sort of macroscopic field, when this becomes comparable to the frequency with which they encounter other charges, other particles, to exchange energy and momentum, so the collision frequency. So let's see what we get from equating these two frequencies. So this would be this gyration frequency, the Larmor frequency, and then on the right-hand side, we'll equate this with the collision frequency. And so from sort of statistical considerations, you can roughly derive a formula for this. Some factor times the logarithm of lambda, which is also known as the Coulomb logarithm. That's essentially a function that sort of weakly depends on temperature and also depends weakly on the charge density. But essentially, you can roughly think of this as a constant for some of the regimes, and then there's some scaling with temperature and obviously with the particle density that should control this collision frequency, obviously. So this is the frequency of collisions between free electrons. So just to get essentially an order of magnitude idea about this. And so you can plug in typical values for magnetic field strength, charge density, temperature, and so on for different astrophysical systems. And so for a star-forming cloud, so I have one set of, just as an example, some typical values for, say, a star-forming cloud would be temperature something like 10 Kelvin, magnetic field strength of 10 to minus 5 Gauss, which is typical sort of interstellar magnetic field strength, then we will get, from equating these two, we'll get a critical charge density of roughly 10 electrons per cubic centimeter, below which this decoupling would occur, and essentially the MHD approximation would break down. And that's actually a rather high charge density. Sometimes you only have, H1 clouds, interstellar H1 clouds have only like one particle per cubic centimeter or even less, 10 to minus one, 10 to minus two particles per centimeter, which is sort of more typical. So this shows that essentially for some very simple astrophysical systems you can think of, actually the MHD approximation would strictly not be valid. But luckily what happens often is that the MHD approximation nevertheless works well. And there's some magic essentially going on that has to do with nonlinear plasma phenomena that even in that sort of in the collision regime lead to properties that still make essentially the plasma occur as a fluid, to behave like a fluid. So interestingly still, for some systems in which at least sort of strictly speaking, the MHD approximation should break down, you can still get a fairly good description with the MHD approximation nevertheless. And so one example is also the, for example, the solar wind. So the solar wind hits the Earth, right, and forms a shock front on the side toward the Earth, and that can actually be perfectly modeled by hydrodynamic MHD simulations, and you'll see this a lot if you look into the literature. Although formally this solar wind does not fulfill this MHD approximation, but nevertheless, using an MHD approach, you can still sort of recover all the basic features of the flow of the solar wind, for example, around the Earth. So that's actually fairly interesting. Okay, any questions so far?
Yeah, so about what you were just saying, so is it understood why you can still get a good, you know, a good solution in spite of the approximation not being valid?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'm not a big expert, to be honest, on that point. So I think in many cases it's not exactly understood why it works well, but there are sort of heuristic reasons of why it may work. So there's sort of nonlinear plasma phenomena, nonlinear waves, and things like that can actually make a fairly collisionless plasma look like sort of like a fluid. So in some cases, this is sort of studied more than in others. And sometimes, in a few cases, it's certainly known why it works well or not. But in others, people take a more sort of crude approach and sort of would just use MHD simulations and sort of compare to observations and see that they can at least recover some of the basic features. So another system is, for example, supernova. So pulsar wind nebulae, for example, where still at some point you have a fairly dilute gas that is almost in a collisionless regime, but nevertheless the hydrodynamic shockwaves and phenomena, sort of the macroscopic features of the system, are still fairly well described.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Thanks.
Okay, any other questions? So if not, then let me just address a little bit this ideal MHD approximation. So let's say we're happy with MHD in general, sort of we think that it may actually well describe the system that we're interested in, then we still have to decide whether or not we want to sort of go down this alley of sort of resistive approach and actually make some effort to actually retain all these additional terms due to resistivity in here, or whether we can actually neglect them and end up with a much simpler system to solve. So also here you can make some basic estimates to convince you about the validity. So this is limits of ideal MHD. So essentially what we're interested in here is now the diffusivity timescale, so this resistive timescale. And essentially it boils down to this timescale argument. You essentially try to evaluate what would be, so if you just let the system relax without any other dynamics, what would be the typical resistive timescale, and is that timescale relevant for the timescale that you're interested in, so for the evolution, the typical characteristic evolution timescale of the system. So for some hydrogen plasma, you can actually write down what the resistivity is roughly, and so there's in the literature, you find sort of some more or less accurate fits to that. And again, here we have this sort of Coulomb logarithm appearing here. And so we have some dependence on the temperature, obviously, again. So that would be the resistivity for actually a fully ionized hydrogen plasma. So in some cases, this resistivity is actually known. The problem with many systems is often you actually don't know what the microphysical resistivity actually is. So there's no sort of fundamental theory that would predict what that resistivity would actually be. And so you can, again, plug in typical values for such a fully ionized hydrogen cloud. So again, these are similar values than what I used in examples before. So you get roughly a value for this Coulomb logarithm of roughly 20 or something. So it's order of 10 to the 1. You can try different densities of 10 to 100 per cubic centimeter or so. Typical scale of like a parsec or so, spatial scale of a parsec. And so you'll end up with something that is very high. So if you compute what the time scale, the resistive time scale would be, then proportional to the inverse of this resistivity. And so you'll find that this is actually on the order of 10 to the 21 years. So this is like 10 to the 11 times the age of the universe. So clearly, if you're interested in some dynamical phenomena of these H2 clouds, these H2 regions, you can clearly neglect resistivity here, and ideal MHD should just be a perfect approximation. So ideal MHD again is actually very good here. But there are exceptions, obviously. So there are other cases in which ideal MHD may not be strictly valid or a good approximation. So the resistive time scale may actually become small in situation where, for example, the magnetic field becomes very entangled and has a very complicated sort of geometry. And so the field can actually self-intersect and reconnect. So this would be for sort of very small characteristic length scales of a system. And so you put a lot of magnetic flux in there and you let it entangle through complicated plasma flows, it may actually have ample opportunity to sort of self-interact and dissipate. And obviously the other limit is when the plasma actually doesn't have as many charges anymore, so only becomes weakly ionized, then obviously as you sort of freeze down essentially a highly ionized medium, so you just decrease the temperature, at some point electrons should recombine with ions, and so the gas should become more and more neutral. And you might wonder, in some clouds or in some sort of protostellar disks or so, protoplanetary disks, for example, at some point you may be too cool for the gas to be in a highly conducting state. And also here, obviously, you can make some crude estimates. So the concern would be that at some point the actual charge density becomes much smaller than the number densities of neutral particles, so that only a tiny fraction of particles in your fluid elements are actually charges. So this would be the number okay again. Number of neutral particles. So say, again, you can write down the resistivity. In such a case, there are, again, approximate sort of formulas for this. So it scales roughly with the ratio of neutral to conducting to the number densities of free electrons. There's, again, some weak temperature dependence. And so that's valid in certain regimes. So here up to temperatures of 10 to the 4 Kelvin or something, if you're not too hot. So let's take essentially this example that I just mentioned, like a protoplanetary disk. So that's sort of an accretion disk that forms around essentially newly formed stars. And out of that disk, it will eventually form planets. And so so let's say that here you have the central star, the young star. And out here, you still have this accretion disk. So think of the solar system, for example. And again, we have some disk height h, and we label the radius by r. Then, you know, if we just take a typical height radius ratio of 0.1 or so, and typical temperatures for such a disk, let's take a characteristic system size of roughly 1.5 times 10 to the 12 centimeters. That would be sort of typical for like the distance of a planet from such a young star. And also a typical lifetime of the disk something like 10 to the 7 years. That's a lifetime. Then what we get is something like 10 to the minus 10 to the minus 6. So for this resistive time scale, be smaller than the disk lifetime, what we require is this ratio to be, so this would be if we essentially equal the two time scales, and so this would have to be much, much smaller than 10 to the minus 6. And so you see that even if there's only really weak ionization, so only a fraction of 10 to the minus 6 of all particles are actually charges, then still this MHD approximation, the resistive timescale would still be fairly long. And so even at these only very moderate ionization degrees, ideal MHD would still be valid. Okay, so just essentially some basic estimates you can do, and essentially this is what you would ideally do before you start a simulation. You sort of think about the system you're interested in, and you try to think about the characteristic time and length scales, characteristic states of your plasma, and try to evaluate sort of whether or not some of these approximations actually make sense. And then essentially you choose your approach and you start your simulation. Okay, any questions up to here? Okay, this is essentially as far as I wanted to go with just giving sort of this brief description review of the MHD equations. There's obviously important and interesting other concepts to discuss, like helicity or flux freezing, which is another important effect in ideal MHD, where you can essentially show that the magnetic field lines are essentially frozen into the plasma. They always move with the fluid elements, essentially. That's sort of interesting and important if you interpret simulations, but I won't go into much detail here because we really want to get also to the numerics next week. So I think I should wrap this up here. And this is essentially as far as I wanted to go MHD-wise. So another topic I wanted to briefly discuss and introduce is radiation transfer and radiation transport, because that is also something you will encounter across astrophysics in all systems. That is obviously very important for simulations. Because it turns out that essentially we receive essentially all information about the universe through photons. And so those are reprocessed either by the system itself as these photons get emitted and reabsorbed, or they become reprocessed in the interstellar or intergalactic medium. So we essentially need to understand the propagation of photons and what happens to those photons. And so radiation transfer is really one of the fundamental pillars of computational astrophysics as well. It turns out that some approximations to radiation transfer can be formulated again as hyperbolic problems, going essentially applying the same methods as we did for the Euler equations or to the Boltzmann equation. You can end up again with moment schemes and hyperbolic conservation laws, and that's actually interesting. And I just wanted to point this out here again quickly. And so the first thing we need to define here is the radiation intensity, because often these problems of radiation transfer are formulated in terms of this field, this variable that is called radiation intensity. And so I'll just write this down here and then explain it with a figure. So the intensity is essentially defined as the energy of photons that pass through some surface, element d sigma, in some direction n, into a solid angle d omega, in some frequency interval nu, and in some time interval dt. So essentially the idea here is that if we look at the radiation field, so as of photons sort of traveling by, and sort of we are as an observer looking at such a flux of photons, right? We can characterize this flux of photons locally by taking some area element d sigma that has some normal vector n. And so we're looking essentially at this, characterize this radiation field just by looking at different angles. So let's say we're looking at photons that sort of flow through this surface element into this direction, characterized by some angle theta. Some solid angle element d omega. Oops. Actually, sorry, this is wrong. So this is essentially our direction n. Apologies. This is actually n. And so this is, say, our point in space x. And so this is exactly essentially what this definition does. So we're looking at photons that travel in this cone. And by sweeping essentially around all 4 pi of the whole solid angle, we get essentially all the information of the radiation field at a given point X. Okay, so with this essentially definition, we can again look at the Boltzmann equation. So it describes obviously the dynamics of photons. So again, phase space for, so photons are massless and travel with the speed of light, obviously. So what would be sort of more appropriate variables to characterize them are is the momentum instead of the actual individual particle velocities u that we've sort of used for the fluid just for convenience. So q denotes momentum here. Okay, so let's look at the Boltzmann equation again. And now we're not sort of thinking in terms of some gas particles or so that led us to derive the Euler equations. Now we're thinking in terms of massless particles or photons. Again, we have this distribution function. So just essentially to remind you, this figure that I have drawn some time ago. So if, again, we look at this phase space, say sort of Q1, X1, that's projected onto some plane. So in phase space, we look at this volume, dQ, dx. And so we have some certain number of photons, dn in there. And so the statistical description would be that we have some distribution function f that tells us exactly how many of those we have per unit volume. So this is the total number. And now we can actually just multiply this with the energy of the photons to get the total energy of radiation in such a control volume in phase space. So we just multiply by h, the Planck constant, times nu, the frequency of the photon in this phase space element between q and q plus dq. So let's evaluate this essentially again for such a beam of photons as we discussed up here. So we can rewrite. So essentially what I want to do is rewrite this as an equation. So rewrite essentially the Boltzmann equation as an equation for the specific intensity the radiation intensity that we defined up there. So as in the so then we'll just take a control volume adjusted to this beam of photons. So essentially, yeah, let me draw this. So we have this again, this we look at some surface element around this point X. And then essentially what we have roughly is a volume the x, that is c. C times dt times n dot d sigma, where again, so n is the direction of this photon flux, and so essentially, c times dt is the length of the photons traveled per unit time dt. So this is roughly the volume that's swept out by such a beam going through this surface element per unit time. Okay, swept out by the beam in time dt. And so for the momentum part, we can rewrite this as going to essentially circle polar coordinates in momentum space. So Q is here just the absolute value of the momentum, which is h nu over c times some unit vector in direction n. And so we can write this momentum space volume element as h nu c squared h over c d nu the omega. And sort of plugging this in into the expression above, we have that the total radiation energy in this control volume and phase space is given by h power of 4 frequency cubed over c squared f of x. And now we've written this as a function of nu, some direction of photons n and t. And so here we have the surface area element and then d nu d omega dt. And so from this relation, so if we compare this, obviously this part here with what we had defined originally up here, as radiation intensity, then we'll have this relation between radiation intensity and the distribution function of photons in phase space, which is h4 frequency cubed over c squared f. Okay, so with this relation at hand, it's essentially just a way of re-expressing the distribution function of photons in phase space, if you want, to write the Boltzmann equation in a more familiar form that you will find a lot when looking at actual applications of radiation transport. So the Boltzmann equation, remember this was the total derivative of the distribution function equals the collisional term. So this is partial derivative with respect to time. So here, again, we have the gradient of spatial gradient of the distribution function with respect to the propagation direction. So this was previously our velocity of the fluid. So now here we have the speed of light of the photons. we don't have a term that comes about due to the two external forces, because photons, there are no external forces on photons. And so these two terms equal the collisional integral on the right-hand side. And so re-expressing the Boltzmann equation now in terms of the radiation intensity, just applying this relation up here, we get this equation. And this is the famous equation of radiation transfer. Okay, and then again, as in the case of a fluid of a gas, here on the right hand side, this collisional term would describe all sorts of interactions of photons with the medium in which they propagate. So this would be characterize all the collisions, all the scatterings and absorption and emission of photons. So essentially all the microphysics, all the sort of molecular, atomic physics, the actions of photons with other fluid constituents, photons with matter. So whatever absorption, scattering, and emission processes you would want to consider in a given problem. Absorption, emission, and scattering. And so what we have here is the directional derivative with respect to the propagation direction. So along a photon path, and so this is why in time independent problems, and this is what you'll see a lot in astrophysics books, where you look at a stationary solution to the equation of radiation transfer, for example, like in a photosphere of a star, and you want to see how radiation is transferred from lower layers to upper layers, and how emission lines and so on and so forth form. And typically you're looking at this in a time independent way. And so actually in most textbooks, you'll find the time independent version of this equation. So time independent problem would be, and then it is directly formulated as a derivative with respect to the propagation direction of photons. And this is essentially the version that you'll find most often cited. Okay, so this is essentially the Boltzmann equation for photons. Now here again we have the same problem as with with a gas, that this is, if we want to put this on a computer, there's again this huge computational challenge that this is a 6+1D problem. Again we have six dimensions in phase space and then the time dimension. So even if we put a moderate number of grid points on a computer, it'll be very hard to actually evolve in practice. So again, so typically the way one would formulate this in a sort of in a computational setting would be to write essentially this radiation intensity function as a function. So we essentially just take circle polar coordinates both in space and in real space and in momentum space. So we'd have sort of more angular variables here. And so you can just make the sort of very trivial estimate that say take 100 grid points, right? 100 grid points in sort of for all these variables, then you end up with power of 6, 10 to the 12 values you need to store per single time step. And it's obvious that this will very soon make it impossible to evolve in practice. So again, here we have to resort to other approaches to simulate or to computationally tackle essentially radiation transfer problems. So only in some sort of with additional assumptions like reduction of effective dimensions by introducing symmetries, like you go to a spherical symmetry, or you go to a sort of a plane parallel setting where you essentially say that there's only essentially one, there's essentially only two spatial dimensions or so. You can sometimes directly solve the Boltzmann equation in this way. But if you want to go to full 3D and take everything into account, even for very coarse numerical settings, you'll be unable to do this computationally. So again, here we have to do a different approach. And again, the idea is and there's also various approximations, I should say, of how to address this problem. But one that is, I think, very nice and very effective and is sort of kind of state of the art, both in terms of photon transport, or if we would also look into neutrinos, for example, it works there as well, is the so-called moment schemes. And it exactly follows the same recipes as we did for the Euler equation. So you can, again, take here the Boltzmann equation for photons, and you make a moment expansion, and you only retain the first few moments of the Boltzmann equation. You'll again end up with a hyperbolic setting or a hyperbolic system of conservation laws, actually, for the photon field that you can solve. So these are known as so-called M1 schemes, for example, where, so in this case, you would only retain the first two moments. And then again, you have to specify a closure relation as we did for with the hydrodynamic equations, with the Euler equations. We had to specify this equation of state that sort of captures all the microphysics, all the missing microphysics that we were essentially dropping by using that approach to close the system. And something similar has to be done here. These are leads to the so-called Eddington factors or Eddington relation that is essentially the analog of the equation of state for photons, if you want. And so with these Eddington relations, you can then close the moment scheme for photon transport. And this is actually what's being done right now in many computational approaches of, for example, accretion disks. These M1 schemes are essentially state of the art. And we also apply them for, as I mentioned, for neutrino transport in, for example, when we collide neutron stars and black holes on the computer, where we get a lot of neutrino radiation, we can actually deal with that in such an M1 fashion. There are also other approaches, obviously, like flux limited diffusion. It's a slightly different approach. Or you can also try to do essentially full Boltzmann transport, as I mentioned, but then you would usually not resort to some sort of grid type setting, as I pointed out here with 6+1 dimensions, but rather what people do is then to do a Monte Carlo transport where you just try to sample the solution of this equation by essentially explicitly following the evolution of individual photons, following all their collisions and interactions with the medium. And that is computationally very challenging, but has also been accomplished in some cases. So there are, for example, applications in the supernova context, in core collapse supernovae, where people have now tried such explicit Monte Carlo radiation transport. And the first applications are now also coming for in other systems like neutron star mergers and other systems where accurate neutrino transport is actually needed. There are obviously limitations to the moment schemes. And so this is why I think this is a fairly sort of hot topic in astrophysics these days. And so this is why I included on the second problem set next week, that'll appear next week, an exercise for you to actually derive the simplest possible moment scheme from the Boltzmann equation for photons. So you'll derive the moment scheme for photons just to get the idea. So you can apply, you can go over essentially the derivations that we did for the Euler equations. You can look at those techniques. You can exactly apply these techniques to the Boltzmann equation for photons and then end up with such a moment scheme. And so that hopefully should be an interesting exercise to do. Okay, any questions so far?
Yeah, I have one, and I don't want to spoil the problem on the problem set if that's part of it. But so you mentioned that, okay, so you have to incorporate those closure relations. So how did you call them? The Eddington?
Yeah. Relation? So exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when you do it for the Euler equation, well, I mean, the equation of state is something that you get sort of phenomenologically, and you just put that in. So how do you do it with the Eddington relations? Where do they come from?
Yeah, that's a good question. So so typically the most simple ansatz you could do is you could try and look at some radiation problems that you can actually solve analytically, for example, where you can actually solve a 1D, say, Boltzmann equation. And then you can actually get a sort of more or less analytic description of how that Eddington closure relation should look like by resorting to sort of some of these special cases. And this is also, I believe historically the first approach that was done to write down such a closure relation. You can then go to sort of more complicated problems where you try to solve in a specific setting this transport problem sort of in more detail and try to see how that sort of deviates from some of the other cases you tried. So nowadays there are also approaches where you can try to sample this actually by Monte Carlo transport. You can try and do like a hybrid scheme where you essentially evolve the moment equations sort of with your typical sort of hyperbolic evolution scheme for conservation laws. And then you try to sample in a sub-step, you try to sample these radiation tensors by Monte Carlo. So you make an intermediate step where you try to sample some of these quantities that you need for the closure relation by Monte Carlo transport and try to get a more accurate idea about this disclosure function. But yeah, in general, this is not easy to estimate, and there's no like first principle approach, as you point out, that you could invoke to write down such a relation. So for the equation of state, at least, depending on the system, there's still some sort of fundamental theory that can predict such a relation, but here it's it is more complicated.
Yeah, interesting. So in practice, do you can you do a good job with some simple function of density and temperature?
Yes.
And Write something down.
Right, exactly. So in practice, this is what people do. They essentially write down fairly simple sort of fitting functions for these closure relations that apparently work fairly well. Essentially what you can do is you can compare your code using such sort of a more heuristically written down or motivated closure relation to like an exact solution of the Boltzmann equation or approximate solution of the Boltzmann equation with radiation transport for like a one-dimensional problem. So you look at the same problem with two different methods and you try to see how well they do and what the effect would be of changing that closure relation a little bit. And so you can get some idea about the influence of that and what the possible errors could be. Obviously, it's not guaranteed that if you go to a completely different problem that this would still hold. But at least this is one way to try to get an idea of how wrong you are, in a sense.
Okay, nice. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Okay, if not, I think, it's 5 p.m. sharp, so no point in going further. The next chapter will be on relativistic hydrodynamics, so we'll just go briefly over the equations in the relativistic case. So far, everything has been Newtonian. And so I also wanted to point out that since many of us are interested actually in relativistic problems, also point out the relativistic versions of the hydrodynamics equations, but also of radiation transfer. And again, show that essentially you can again formulate this in terms of hyperbolic problems, and so even in the GR case, you can resort to then sort of standard methods for numerical methods for hyperbolic conservation laws. So that will be the program for the agenda essentially for Tuesday. Okay, if there are no further questions. And enjoy your evening and see you all on Tuesday. Thanks.
Thank you, Daniel.
Bye-bye.
Bye. See you then.
Thank you.